There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Today we're tackling how to deal with difficult people in our lives. This could be in the workplace, it could be in your social life, or even within your family. Is there a particular person that you have to deal with regularly who is, well, quite frankly, a real jerk? What are the best ways of interacting with that person, and how do we make sure that they don't influence our own behaviour in negative ways? Dr. Raymond Hamdan is in the studio keeping me company today. He's a clinical and forensic psychologist from the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. Good morning to you, Dr. Raymond.
Hi, good morning. Nice to see you on New Year's Eve.
Yes, that's true. Happy New Year's Eve to you. Good to have you in as usual. And as well as keeping me on the straight and narrow, of course, today, Dr. Raymond is also here to give us the benefit of his mind and experience applied to our discussion topic today, of course, but also to offer advice on any issues you might want to raise today. Dr. Raymond, let's start with our topic today. Dealing with difficult people, and something I think we'll probably hear a lot from our listeners on today, because we've all had it, haven't we, particularly in the workplace, I guess, which is where we're going to start. We were inspired by a book from Stanford University, a book by a professor from Stanford University in the US, Professor Robert Sutton, and the name of his book is The A-Hole Survival Guide: How to Deal with People Who Treat You Like Dirt. And he was specifically talking about in the workplace. He's had a little fun with the title there, but it's a serious issue, isn't it, if you're working with somebody who is a jerk or a bully, particularly if they're your boss.
Many people come from backgrounds where they're not allowed to confront or question anybody in authority, whether they're good, bad, or ugly. So what happens many times is we run into that jerk, and that jerk could be a woman, not just a man, who's being very, very rough with everybody. And sometimes the reason that they do it is they might be feeling lonely and they want to suppress the environment around them. So they think that they're not going to lose those people. They'll be afraid to leave, or they'll know that they're not good enough to ever go anywhere. And that's called the mushrooming effect. That's very popular in the industry around businesses. Sometimes the person might actually be a real bully. And that bully is usually an overcompensation for feeling weak, for low self-esteem. And it might even be the Napoleon syndrome, where they're small bodies and they're trying to overcompensate by being the big bully. And these actually can be people who are in an entrepreneur situation or take on a leadership role for the wrong reason. A person who can also be a jerk is an obsessive compulsive person who has to have everything perfectly done the way they want them done. You also have people who are displacing anger from home, and they bring it on to the people at work who they know cannot argue with them, cannot qualify what they're doing against them, because they'll lose their jobs. And with the employment laws, that might be easy to do. So sometimes people take advantage of this. So that bully, that jerk, might actually be a person who's got their own psychological hang-ups. We also know that people deal with anger in different ways. Anger is a normal reaction to hurt or frustration. But what you do with the anger can be right or wrong. That's where the issue of anger comes in. That becomes debatable. Not that it's a normal reaction to something. What happens physiologically during anger is the adrenaline level goes up. Well, a little bit of adrenaline going up is good for you, because that adrenaline mixes with the chemicals in the hippocampus, which is part of the midbrain. Even though memory is all over the body, in every cell and tissue in the body, where it's regulated mostly according to neurospecialists, is in the hippocampus area. So that chemical that we call adrenaline mixes with the chemicals of the hippocampus, which actually keeps you sharp. Like, I've been doing radio now with this network for quite a long time. And every time that the microphone goes on, I have a little bit of anxiety. And that's to keep me sharp. I'm glad I have that, because I could become really cocky and not really care and make mistakes. But that little bit of anxiety keeps me sharp. And those of you who do regular public speaking probably have the same little bit of anxiety. And even though you're a polished media person, you may also realize that right before you go onto the show, do I know enough? Do I have everything down? That's good. What happens with people in the anger management level is the adrenaline level goes up really high. And that's like putting in too many plugs into a electric circuit, and it causes a breakout. So what happens when the breaker goes off, everything goes off. Same thing happens in the brain. When there's too much information coming in too rapidly, the anxiety goes up. That means the adrenaline goes up. They all of a sudden have that anxiety that blocks everything. So this is where, for instance, people who go for tests experience test anxiety, where they don't remember anything. What we've seen with anger management in the workplace, there are some people under observation that can actually become violent and not know it. At first, you think, oh, it's just an excuse. They're just trying to subside away from the criminal act that they did, and it is a crime to hit somebody. But after observation, and they're teaching techniques not to do that, and they still have the problem or the tendency to do that, you start realizing that there is a blackout when they start reporting that. Now, this is not an excuse. This is an explanation. So there are people at different levels. Some people who are intentionally difficult, their difficulty is a symptom of other things. They could even reach the level of violence and not even realize that they've reached that level.
So what if we're on the receiving end of one of those levels? Let's start with that. Let's not get to the physical aggression level, because I think probably most people would be able to take a complaint forward there. What if something's a bit more subtle, I guess, and somebody's just constantly making your life difficult at work through that, either their attitude towards you, the way they treat you in front of your colleagues, I guess a bully. What can we do there? Let's start with some tips for people how to deal with it.
Yes, that's a good point to go towards, because bullying is a form of abuse, and there's different kinds of abuse. Abuse can be not only physical or sexual abuse, but it can be verbal abuse, emotional abuse. And sometimes what bosses have been known to do is social abuse and economic abuse, controlling who their employees will talk to, where they will go, who they will do with what. And they then control them economically, not giving them all the money that's due to them, telling them, well, we can't afford it right now, we'll pay you back later, controlling them on their benefits, giving them one contract when they come in, but then changing it after they're already there. There's all kinds of stuff. This government does not tolerate that. There are labor laws, and what the individual can do is they can go complain. However, when there's not the sufficient physical evidence, you can still complain based on emotional abuse, but you have to have witnesses. Now, when people come to us as psychologists to actually do the assessment, what we're going to be doing is looking at their way of thinking, feeling, and behavior as a result of what they're complaining about. Now, anybody can come in and have all kinds of complaints, and they might not even be real. A lot of people are happy to lie just to get the benefits. It's a secondary gain. But when it is real, what we start seeing are symptoms that match exactly what we call post-traumatic stress disorder. And these symptoms are so vivid through the description, through the repeated questioning, and the consistency of the answers from other reports that may come from other employees at the time, and we match those to look at it not just clinically but forensically, then you can go to the authorities and be able to prosecute, or you're able to leave without penalty of leaving.
We were just touching there, Dr. Raymond, on the ways, obviously, if something's a very overt aggression, you have courses of action you can take, you can file complaints and what have you. But what if something's not really necessarily aggression or anger? What if somebody's just being what you consider plain rude at work? What are the steps we can take to try to work out, A, what's behind that behaviour, B, how can we deal with it? Where do we start if someone's just openly rude to us in the office, for example?
There's a lot of different personalities in the workplace, and not everybody is a robot. Very few will be. So people have their personalities that they bring into the picture. Now, some people have been brought up in homes that were abusive homes, whether it was a histrionic mother or father, whether it was parents who had their own difficulties going on, they ignored the children. And they were very, very punitive with the kids just to keep them quiet so they could get on with their selfish adult problems. Children sometimes are brought up in that kind of an environment, which will affect the way that they will work in an authority environment where they're treated the same by their boss. Some people also come from communities where there's what's called power distancing, is a term that was developed by Kirk Hofstede even back in the 1950s, that talks about how people come from certain cultures where they feel inferior to other cultures, and they refuse to tell the authority figure what they believe needs to be changed. Even when the authority figure is doing something wrong and could be destructive, they will not confront the authority. Some people come from cultures where they believe that they are the authorities, no matter what their position is within the company, and everybody has to listen to them regardless. These all will play into the dynamics at work. So taking those variables, we can also look at what is in the code of ethics that says when a person behaves inappropriately, you tell them about it. You ask them about what they're doing. If you want to find out why they're doing it, you even have that option. Some people say, I don't care why they're doing it. They have to stop it. I'm just going to say this is inappropriate. It's unacceptable. If that doesn't work, you go to their first line supervisor. If that doesn't work, you go to the human resources department. So there are forms of etiquette. There is a form of protocol to handle these situations. And if they don't stop, that's where you can go the legal route.
But if I'm stood in the office and somebody, or say in a meeting, so it's a small group of people, it's in a meeting, someone is what I consider very rude to me about, say, an idea I've had. What do I do there? Do I fight fire with fire? Do I throw rudeness back at them? Or do I try to be diplomatic? Do I try to reason with them? What are the tools I can use?
If a person is rude, that doesn't mean that they're angry. It might be just a learned behavior.
No, but it might mean they're a jerk, right?
But yeah, they could be a pseudo jerk or whatever. Yeah, you're right. So what happens is when people are behaving in that way and you don't know the source of it, you do also want to be respectful, first for yourself and then of the other person. And sometimes being respectful of the other person is a way of showing respect of yourself by not being hostily confrontive, by not referring to them or behaving with them the way they behaved with you, but going to the side with them, saying, I don't appreciate the way that that was handled. You don't have to talk to me in this tone. And you may not know it, but your voice goes up unnecessarily. You become very loud, and it's very piercing to hear you in that tone of voice. So you can actually go there. If the person is confident in the relationship that they have with that superior working individual, superior meaning that they're in a higher position on the corporate structure. So if they have the confidence that that person's response will be favorable and grateful for making mention of that, then by all means, go to that person and indicate to them what your observation is. But again, just because they embarrassed you doesn't mean that you have to embarrass them. You can actually be a model by saying, I'd like to where you confront them in a very polite manner, respectful manner. If that doesn't work again, then you go through the hierarchical process. However, let's say that the person really is a jerk and they really want to bark at everybody and they don't care what anybody thinks. They're very arrogant. They're intolerant. Then you're going to have a real problem. Some of the things that people will report they'll have is they'll wake up in the morning not even wanting to go to work. They may have difficulty sleeping at night knowing that they have to work the next day. They're looking forward to a lonely weekend, which is better than an aggressive atmosphere at work. So they go through these anxieties, the depressions. They have nightmares about the workplace. I've actually had people that talked about that. But before you even get there, there's a way to nip it in the bud. And the way that you can do that is when people at work are going to be talking about this situation, gear it into a productive way than a destructive way. Because many times when they start making aggressive statements against the authority who's behaving this way, it doesn't even have to be an authority. It could be one of their peers who's behaving this way. What they'll find is they start talking about war stories. My war story is bigger than your war story. My trauma was more traumatic than your trauma. This can be very destructive. And it doesn't go anywhere, of course. So what you want to be able to do is gear it into a productive format. And the productive format is, what can we do about it? Maybe if we are collectively addressing this to this superior officer in the corporate structure, that may then gain the momentum. And there's actually been people that have done that. They've gathered to not go attack the person, but they've gathered to put together their ideas, their thoughts, and also how to change things productively to avoid the destruction.
And it's interesting you bring that up, changing things productively and also being a force for change. You mentioned being a model for change, because one of the things that comes up in Dr. Sutton's book is the fact that he says nasty behaviour often breeds more nasty behaviour. None of us are immune to becoming jerks, he says. If you go into a corporate culture that is a certain way, you may well develop into that. So I want to get your thoughts on that shortly, Dr. Raymond, because that's quite interesting. A lot of us would say we would never be like that, but he, according to Dr. Sutton, we could all turn into jerks if we're in the wrong environment. So that coming up. Also, we're keen for you to share your stories, of course, today. Some of your stories coming in now, and we will be getting to those soon. A good message in here from Jane. She says, great topic. My old boss used to put me down, embarrass me, speak to me in a rude tone, and I never stood up to him. What I learned to say is, you seem to be stressed. Is there something you need help with? It has worked quite well for me, putting it back to that person who speaks to me in a way I don't like. I quite like that way of dealing with it.
Yes, she neutralized him.
Right, okay. So talk us through that tactic.
The neutralization process is you be sensitive enough to wonder, why is that person doing what they're doing? Rather than taking it personally, rather than feeling attacked and having to attack back, go through your own sensitivity and analyze what's going on with them. Like, for instance, if a person's angry, you may assume that they've been hurt over, they've had their feelings hurt over something. If a person is behaving resentfully, you might think that they may be feeling guilty about something. Well, you don't want to confront them on the guilt, because that could be too much of an attack for them. But it's okay when you see them angry to say, something must have been bothering you. Is there something that can help you do? Or you seem very upset about this. Is there anything that I can help solve that? This neutralizes them. And the neutralization process is very important, because it lets them realize somebody might be interested in hearing me. Many times bullies or jerks at work are people that don't feel heard. They don't feel that anybody cares about them. They feel that they're making all these strides to make a difference, to make things better for their family, for their company, for their country, and nobody cares. So it could be because they feel unappreciated because of their own peers confronting them or situations, or something didn't happen at home the way that they wanted it to happen, so they displace that anger. When people also are in the workplace, and they start to think that they have to become defensive against something like that, that can snowball and become worse. So if you can first look at neutralizing the problem by recognizing what could be the source, you could solve a lot of problems. Now, believe it or not, this same pattern works at home. And this is what I recommend to people in a marriage situation, where they get to the point in marriage where they don't want to understand each other. There's too much hurt that's been piled up on both sides. It only takes one person to break that bad cycle by being sensitive and saying, I'm sorry, I must have hurt you in some way, and I apologize for that, but just let me know what it is so I can correct it, because I might not be fully aware of how I've hurt you. Now, that's something you could do at home with your partner. That might not be the same wording you'd want to use at work with the boss. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but you might not have that kind of a close relationship with whoever is your boss.
Do you think also it was Jane's way of more subtly pointing out that this boss's behavior wasn't really acceptable? In addition, maybe she was being caring, and you're right, she was trying to understand the other side of the story. But is it also not a sort of a more or a less confrontational way of pointing out, hey, your behavior, it's not on?
That's very correct, because that is the part of neutralization. See, what you're doing is you're addressing the person's aggression in a non-aggressive matter. So they will usually get the hint.
So it breaks that cycle, I guess.
Exactly. And don't be surprised if there are people who are not sensitive enough to get the message. I've met people like that. I've met one of my peers, actually, who happened a long time ago to be that kind of a person. What he was, he was feeling so insecure about who he was. Anytime anybody made a mistake, he would jump on that one mistake and repeat it to death. It was almost like he would deliberately want to make you feel bad. Now, one of the things you learn early, nobody can make you feel anything. So what I used to do with this one particular guy is, whenever he would do something like that, I would listen to him. And I said, now, are you finished? He said, yeah. And I said, well, do you feel better about yourself by making me look stupid? Now, he never made me look stupid, but I wanted to tell him that to give him a false sense of power, because it was my turn then to turn around and cruelly hit him. And what I would do with him, now guys can do this with each other. If you don't have a basketball court to go to where we can knock each other over and pretend it was just playing a game, when it's really a way to hurt the person for hurting you, girls do it a lot differently. But in the office, what you can do, what guys do, sometimes they'll wait and turn it around. So what I would do is, he was trilingual. And what I would say to him, and I said, by the way, you speak three languages. Have you ever said anything in any of those languages that anybody really cared about?
What did he say?
He didn't. He couldn't say. He just turned
speechless?
Around and walked away. You know, because what I did is, that was my way of attacking him.
Mm.
And I did that deliberately because I know him well enough. He wasn't a superior, he was a peer. Now, a lot of people argue that point, saying that that was not a nice thing to have said to him. And you're right, it wasn't a nice thing. But I knew the person. I've had a long-term relationship with him at work, as well as some personal interactions with our families getting together. So I knew I could get by with saying that, and would not have the same impact that it would somebody I didn't know. Because if I say that to somebody I don't know, that would be considered a jerk behavior from my side.
Yeah, and you wouldn't necessarily in the workplace use that tactic with a boss, for example. That could be a little dangerous for
you.
But maybe a colleague, maybe a peer.
That's very correct. So you have to know where your position is in the company. You also have to be able to understand what could be their reaction. And if you can't predict their reaction, it's better not to do anything. It's better to be wrong for having not reacted than be wrong for having reacted.
So thanks for that story, Jane. I hope it did work out for you and it's becoming more bearable because of that. Let's talk now, Dr. Raymond, about that point in the book we mentioned at the beginning of the show, which is The A-Hole Survival Guide, How to Deal with People Who Treat You Like Dirt. And Dr. Sutton, who wrote the book, talks about the fact that nasty behaviour breeds more nasty behaviour and that none of us are immune to becoming jerks. Do you agree?
Yes. Now, humans, however, I believe, are people who want to be good. We're humans and we want to be good. We want to find harmony. We want to find balance. We want to find cooperation. We want to find solutions. But unfortunately, as we live in the world where there are people who are not as nice and seem to, for whatever reason, go in a direction that is destructive, lacking harmony, they're complainers, never seeing the positives, we have to deal with that as well. What happens in the world today is that when you're forced into a situation that's unpleasant, either you're going to fight or you're going to flight. If you fight, you try to become a jerk, and it becomes like in the work that was done, and I'm not saying it parallels it immediately, I'm sorry, I'm not saying it is exactly the explanation, but parallels it. Work that was done at Stanford by Dr. Phil Zimbardi, The Prisoner Dilemma. What he found is that when people are put into the prisoner role, their behavior became prison-like, almost subdued, even though they might try to rebel. When people were put in the policeman role, they became aggressive, controllers. They tried to oppress the prisoners. So that kind of behavior, it becomes role-modeled, and what you expect when you're in an aggressive position or in a passive position. Well, take that to the workplace. If a person's in a role where they believe that they are to be submissive, they'll go into what's called learned helplessness. They'll think that they have no choice, nobody else wants them, they're not good enough, and they're stuck there. That's where you see the depression, the anxiety, the physiological complaints start to happen. There's a lot of absenteeism. There may be even substance abuse just to deal with day to day as if it's medicinal effect. So you see all kinds of negative things happening. You see their family relations being compromised. And that's because their psychological integrity is being compromised at work.
I mean, you're at work for a lot of hours in the day, aren't you? So it's immensely debilitating if you're having trouble.
Isn't it amazing if you like where you're working and you feel that you're appreciated? 8 hours, 10 hours is not enough. You're happy to stay there more. But if you're under a lot of stress because of environmental pressures that are unbecoming of the usual human existence, what you'll find is 1 hour is way too much.
Mm.
You start counting the minutes. It's like sitting in a foreign language class in the ninth grade.
Clock watching,
and your
yes.
teacher is boring. You know, and you just
it's never going to end.
Yeah, I say, when will I get out of high school?
So I'm thinking about somebody who starts, you know, maybe their first job. They start in a company which has a culture of people, say, for example, being rude to each other or barking orders rather than asking nicely to do something. Not much of a feedback system in terms of positive reinforcement. If, according to Dr. Sutton, then that person's going to develop those behaviours. He says that emotions are remarkably contagious and negative emotions are more contagious than positive emotions. I like to think even if I went into a place where the culture was to treat subordinates badly or rudely, I like to think I wouldn't join in. Am I being naive?
No, not at all. Some people won't join in, but there are some who think they have no choice and they have to comply. And sometimes those are the people that come from cultures that says we have to be submissive unto others, so we have to be feeling very lucky to have this job, to have any kind of an income. And many times I hear those kind of complaints. Now, let's say that you walk into a place that you think is going to be a good place to work because it matches your academic background. It also enables you to intellectually thrive, but emotionally, the corporate culture is just the opposite of your personality. You are not going to thrive. There's no alignment. It's going to be very destructive to you physically and psychologically. Now, in this case, it doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. It doesn't mean there's even something wrong with the company, believe it or not. It's just that there's no alliance. You need to get out of there. Now, as psychologists, what we do when we help companies with their HR, we support HR to look at hiring. One of the things we actually do is we do a corporate analysis. We want to know what the corporate culture is. I had one gentleman, very, very wise man, who had many years of experience. He became more spiritually inclined. He used to say, I want you to help me understand my corporate spirit. So he would even go there. People that wanted to work there wanted to work there because it was a fabulous company. It was very well known internationally. Happened to be in the Washington, D.C. area where they had one of their headquarters. So I had a pleasure of working with him and his colleagues. There were people who could not fit there, even though they were brilliant at what they did. They wouldn't fit the corporate culture. They wouldn't fit the corporate spirit because part of matching employees with the company, whether they're going to be executive level or labor level, is do they match and will align with the corporate spirit, the corporate culture. It doesn't mean that one is good or one is bad. It just means that there has to be an alignment. And many times the most brilliant people don't thrive if the corporate spirit is not part of their understanding, their personality profiling that would help them thrive in that environment.
So very important to consider the corporate culture when we're job hunting in addition to everything else.
It's actually paramount. So people will go to work because they're already knowledgeable, they're skilled, and they want to be able to apply their knowledge and their skills. But they may be in an environment where all that will not be allowed, not because somebody's stopping them, it's because the corporate structure, the corporate environment does not allow that kind of thriving. Now, interestingly, having said that, there are people that actually thrive in that kind of stress.
So it might work for them. If people are barking orders at each other, they're quite happy with that. It doesn't bother them. So you have to know your own personality.
Yeah. And we've actually consulted with companies where it was very stressful for most people, but there was the people that actually applied there that would fit that culture. And they actually thrived under that kind of stress. You know, it's like when you walk into a hospital. A hospital usually has an emergency room. It also has inpatient, and it also has outpatient. Outpatient will have many different kind of clinics. Not every physician has the same personality. There are physicians who have a personality that can handle emergency room situations. There are physicians who don't want to have any emergency whatsoever. So they go into professions where they see patients, they help them with their ailments, and they go home. They don't have to worry about emergency calls. There are some physicians who don't even want to work with the human being. They'd rather do radiology and pathology. That doesn't mean that there's something wrong with them. It's just a personality preference. And where this comes out, many times you see physicians who are trained as radiologists and pathologists, but they just got married also, and they haven't paid back their medical school loan. So they have to do night work in the emergency room. it's very stressful for them. Some people like to have a career where it's method oriented and you know what's going to be expected. Emergency room physicians have got to be people who can handle the stress. They don't have time to go re-research something. They have to be ready at the moment. As a matter of fact, that's what we do on this show. And that's what makes this show so interestingly. You don't know the callers that are going to come in. This is emergency room psychology. You know, Dr. Phil.
We like to live on the edge, Dr. Raymond.
I do. It's part of my personality. Where Dr. Phil, Dr. Ruth have done beautiful work to represent psychology. They've done wonderful work. But it's okay that they actually have rehearsal time with everybody that they're going to interview. They don't have the emergency room situations. I love the emergency room situation. And that's actually when I was doing my internship working in a hospital. My favorite place to go was actually sit in the emergency room and work with the physicians there. Because it was amazing to watch how everything that they've learned has to come to the surface. And you got to be able to remember what the latest research to help in that situation. Or you pick up the telephone and talk to one of your colleagues that can help too. But you don't always have that time to say, why don't we get together for coffee tomorrow and discuss this? It's got to be right then and there, whether it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 3 o'clock in the morning.
It's interesting, isn't it, the different types of energy that different people thrive off. And we're talking about dealing with difficult people at work. And we were touching there, Dr. Raymond, on bullies, how to deal with them, what have you. We sort of ended by saying one person's rudeness can be another person's efficiency. And I kind of want to just delve into that a little bit. What about if you're made aware that you are the bully at work? You are the difficult person, the jerk at work. Maybe you didn't realize, but somebody like Jane, who messaged in earlier, has sort of brought it to your attention that actually your behavior isn't that great. Have you had people come to you with those kind of issues where they've suddenly realized that they are the bully?
Many times there are people that realize it and they don't want to do anything about it. But the times where they do want to do something about it, of course, they're going to come in and seek help. And they usually go to a psychologist who would be qualified in these areas to help them. And the thing that we do a full assessment. We want to know what's going on physiologically, psychologically. We also want to know how they were raised, what was happening in their homes. Because many of them may have actually come from homes where they were bullied and didn't know it because that was a way of life at home. And when your life and your world is your home, especially at a young age, you never question it. You don't even know it's abnormal until you start visiting with other people in their homes to realize that, wow, this family function is completely different. Now, if you get parents who suffer from some particular disorder, they don't want you to know what's going on in somebody else's home. So part of the abuse is the social abuse. They won't let you visit with friends. They won't let friends come over to your house because they want to keep contained what they know is a problem, but don't want to change it, nor do they want to admit it publicly. So what we see is with people who are abusers, who are bullies, who are aggressive in nature, is there is a large percentage of them, and I'm going to say 66%, if I recall the research correctly. It may have changed a little bit now. I remember 73% someplace, were people who were abused themselves or came from that kind of environment, and they didn't know any other way of behaving. So of those people who seek help, who acknowledge that they may, or they acknowledge that they do, have abusive tendencies or aggressive tendencies, and they're taught new coping strategies, will actually change. 66% of them will change. There's another percentage who may not be able to or may not want to. Now, a lot of times we see that people use the chemicals and the internal hormones as an excuse, and that is an excuse. Yes, there may be the baseline that is chemical, but that is not an excuse to misbehave. So even if you have an explanation, we know enough in the way of the life of people today all over the world that that's unacceptable behavior. So there's
you
medication.
You can deal with that through, okay, medication.
Yeah, we go with medication. We also have techniques that don't take the place of medication, but they are good ways to help the person control the behavior. And there is a percentage of people when learning these techniques, like relaxation techniques, yoga, prayer, meditation, biofeedback, different kinds of techniques. We change diets because many times people have an allergic reaction to sugars, preservatives, things like that. That actually helps them change. We've found a large percentage. As a matter of fact, in our research, in our practice, both in the United States and here, we found that by changing the diet, 70% of the symptoms actually went away because people didn't even know that they were having allergic reactions
And it was affecting their behavior in terms of maybe making them short-tempered, lacking in patience, what have you.
Exactly, Claire, exactly. And what we're finding is that people assume that an allergy is something that causes you to break out. So you're going to have red stuff all over your mouth and face and your eyeballs. That's not always the case. It can actually change in behavior. And we see this, for instance, with children who suffer from attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Even though the American pediatrics don't want to admit that the diet actually was the cure, it isn't the cure, but it is certainly an important element that can control and subdue some of that aggressive behavior. So we're seeing that what you take into your body can also dictate how you're going to think, feel, and behave. So we want to look at people holistically. We're very solution-oriented in this, as we'll talk about things that people can do in the workplace if it matches their personality style, their personality preference. Some people have personalities where they can be confronting, others don't. So when a person comes to us seeking help, we're not going to just say, okay, here's the help. You know, take this pill or do this particular exercise. Not at all. We want to help them see a new them. We want them to have a new discovery. We want to show them different options. What are the solutions that they could take that are still within the realms of their intellectual ability, their emotional stability, that will dictate how they're going to behave?
We'll definitely come on to some of those. I'll give the final word this hour to Saeed, who says, one of the reasons I hated my previous job was because the directors bullied junior employees. They tried that nonsense with me once and I gave them a piece of my mind, never again. So dealing with it quite up front, Saeed, thank you very much for your message. Talking about dealing with difficult people, we've sort of been dealing predominantly so far, Dr. Raymond, with the workplace. We sort of tackled a lot of scenarios, what you can do, how you can deal with people. We're going to move on now a little bit to more personal relationships and dealing with difficult people that maybe are in your social groups or even in your family. And I want to kick off this hour by reading you something from a section in the UK's Guardian newspaper. The section is called A Letter To, and you can basically send a letter to it anonymously, dealing with anything really. And this one, bear with me, it's quite a long letter, but it is really interesting. It's from a sister to her brother. It's titled, A Letter To My Brother, the Bully. I don't suppose, it reads, we will ever speak again. I avoid any and all family occasions that would mean our paths would cross. These are statements that have massive ramifications as we enter a phase of life where there are family weddings and our parents become elderly. But these I am willing to accept, even though this means missing out on important events that cannot be replayed. It hurts a lot, but the alternative would hurt more. You are a bully. You bully people in the workplace and proudly talk about it at family events. You bully your children when you slap them and yank them around. You bully your wife with your affairs. You switch off your phone when you are out late and can't face being honest with her. And you bully me when life gets tough and have done so since we were teenagers. You are weak. Your strength comes from our family, who fear that if they speak out against you, you will simply disappear out of their lives so they lose contact with you, not only you, but also your children. And they continue to welcome you in their lives because they would rather have you than not. This means they sit quietly when you lash out at your children. They smile weakly at your tales from work. And they find reasons why your behaviour is a reflection of your difficult relationship with a high maintenance wife. But I do not make the same choice that they do. I have always been the one that you turned on, when things in your life weren't working. It has continued for decades, and the last round of upset has made me realise that nothing is ever going to change, ever. For you, I will always be the emotional punch bag, and for the rest of the family, there will always be excuses made for you. The rewriting of events to paint you in a more favourable and less culpable light. For me, that is not a dynamic that I want to take part in anymore. I find that really sad, first of all, to read, Dr. Raymond, because I have a lovely brother and a lovely sister who I would be mortified to think had any of those kind of feelings about me or I for them. But it really is quite a brave letter as well.
It is a very brave letter, and she had to do it from a distance. She couldn't do it face to face, and that's not certainly a criticism at all. That might have been the only way that she would be able to tell her brother how she actually thought, felt, and why she's behaving with distance and completely burying him psychologically. She has to put him to rest. She's got to get closure on that. And if her parents weren't going to be there to support her or to protect her from him, then she has to do it herself. And this is not an unusual scenario where one sibling completely divorces themselves from that hostile, aggressive sibling, and then the whole family. It is sad that she's even acknowledging that one day there's going to be an event where I'm not going to be able to enjoy that event because you're there, she's saying to her brother. Even sad events like the death of a parent, she might not even be able to go to the funeral because of the fact that her brother is going to be there. So these are sad situations. Trying to bring them back together may be fruitless because the person who is the bully claims to change intellectually, but emotionally they're not. It's also a dynamic where the psychologist may only see them once or twice or three times a week, maybe, at times. But what are you going to do with the other 168 hours that they may be lying about their behavior or denying the behavior? So the only salvation for the person who's the victim is to completely stay away, not have anything to do with them at all. And this may actually be their salvation. It may be the only way that they can cope is to have that person out of their life. Now, when a person does want to make change and they deliberately are seeking help to make change and they're taking the recommendations and the new behaviors that's being rehearsed in a therapeutic milieu to heart and they're making those changes and the other person still doesn't want to accept them, there could be a couple of reasons for that. Maybe they've seen these kind of attempts for change all along and they don't trust it. It might be that there's so much anger in them that they refuse to forgive them. It could be other things that they're actually angry with the parents for not having stopped them or controlled them from hurting siblings or may not even been aware of it. So there's a lot of reason that people will never get to forgiveness or they refuse to get to forgiveness. And maybe one of the reasons that they refuse to get to forgiveness is because they're afraid that if they forget it, the other person will forget, if they forgive it, the other person will forget it, and the same problem will happen again. We see the same thing with any anxiety. Sometimes people find it difficult to give up their anxiety because they're afraid that if they're not anxious about a situation, that they're not prepared for the worst-case scenario. So when a person has been a victim and they've been abused, they don't want to forgive the other person. They always want to stay on guard because they don't know when the next hit might come at them.
Well, I think when you read or hear that letter in particular, it's clearly gone to extremes for that person because they're prepared to remove themselves from happy and sad family gatherings rather than deal with something that might mean the brother's behaviour changes. And one of the paragraphs in it refers to the fact that the rest of the family are well aware that this guy behaves like this, but they're not doing anything to deal with it. Do you feel like in most scenarios, as a family, you should get together and try to deal with it together rather than one of you having to leave the family, essentially?
The best way to handle it is as a family. The best way to deal with it is as a family, because one of the reasons that the sister is having difficulty to re-engage with the brother is because she doesn't feel protected. So even though she is very angry with her brother, who is a bully, and she prefers never to have him as her brother again, she may also be very angry at the parents for not having protected her. So she can't even protect herself from that situation because mom and dad, who's supposed to have been her protectors, her providers, her nourishers, her bonders, weren't there doing their job. And it appeared to her psychologically that they were siding with the bully brother, even though they may not have been conscious of that.
Well, he might be sort of bullying them as well, I guess.
And that happens. That happens. Or he gets sick and they have to divert their attention, and the sister may have been left out of the picture completely, never even being treated like a daughter, because there was never enough time. The brother always took all the attention when he was being good or when he was being bad.
Draining all of that energy. So let's say it hasn't got to an extreme like that, but you are dealing with somebody in your family who is difficult, who is a jerk, if we go back to that word that we were using earlier in the programme. What kind of ways or what kind of methods could we use, Dr. Raymond, to start to raise that issue within the family before it gets to the stage that that letter writer's clearly got to?
People need to be educated, and a lot of people don't understand that the educational process is paramount, because many times the lack of awareness, which is ignorance, is seen as something bad. Being ignorant isn't bad. It just means you're not aware of what's going on. You're not knowledgeable of what's happening. You'd be surprised how sometimes just making people aware of what they're doing or make people aware of what's happening around them can take away much of the problems. And this is becoming a situation that's paramount. It's becoming more obvious. Whenever I've done programs in various places, around schools, for instance, one of the topics that always comes up is, what do we do with our children who are being bullied? How do we help them? I've also had parents that have come to me and said, my child is the bully. How do I stop my child from being a bully? And that in itself becomes a campaign in itself, because many times the parents who are not bullies themselves don't have control over everything that their children do or they see. You got to be very careful with media. There is a lot of visual media, not just television commercial programs, but even non-commercial programs. There's a lot of screen time that children are watching that parents aren't even aware of, that have a lot of violence. And a little child doesn't know reality from fantasy. When I was visiting with one of my kids before I came to Dubai a few weeks ago, one of their children happens to be 3 years old. And he was just playing with his mom's phone. And all of a sudden, a song comes up that says, how many ways to kill yourself? Now, he would not have known that he picked that song. We would not have known he was listening to that song if we hadn't been at the table. And he was innocently just playing the song that came up. But when we actually heard the wording, we began to realize how dangerous things are. And this is why parents have to monitor. So parents, don't blame yourself first. Look at the environment. What is your child exposed to? At school, television, screen situations, and not just commercial, radio, what are they listening to? How are the friends playing with each other? We also see a lot of aggression even in cartoons today. Well, for a child who doesn't know any other option, they think that's normal. So they start playing with each other in the way that's modeled. Albert Bandura, back decades ago, talked about social learning theory. And what children see, they will behave. As a matter of fact, the research even went further. They took eight-year-old children who were third graders in the American system. They had two different classrooms. One classroom was shown for 3 minutes only an aggressive program on television. Another classroom was shown 3 minutes of a pleasant, cooperative, playful, sing-along kind of a program. Then both groups were put out on the playground. You don't have to be a psychologist to figure out what happened. The kids who were viewing the aggressive show for only 3 minutes behaved aggressively on the playground. The kids who were shown the pleasant cooperative program behaved that way out on the playground. Now, when you have both of those classes playing together, there's going to be some problems, because the aggressive classroom may continue to behave aggressively. The more they play aggressively, the other classroom may have to become defensive and take care of themselves, despite the purpose of the show to help them learn that their environment, their exposure, can help them be harmonious and cooperative. They might not be able to do that if the other is overwhelming them. Wouldn't it be nice if everybody was influenced by the harmonious cooperation rather than the strong, aggressive posture?
It would be nice, but we know in real life, unfortunately, that doesn't always happen, does it? But clearly, the roots of difficult behaviour or bullying behaviour can run deep and go back quite some distance. Dr. Raymond, toxic friendships. I'm thinking that in this part of the world, the way that the population is made up, the way it can be, obviously it's quite transient, we often find ourselves thrown into situations where we make friends very quickly, and sometimes that can lead to relationships that develop into something that's a little bit imbalanced because we haven't got that history together. We've maybe felt that we needed to make friends quickly, otherwise we were going to be lonely here. And then after a while, you spend time with people that maybe aren't actually that good for you. What do you do then?
Well, it's a normal process. You got to get to know people first, but then that doesn't mean you can't be friendly, but can you actually be friends? So it's not like walking up to the person and saying, look, you really look nice. I'd like for you to be my best friend. So let's start now. I'm going to tell you all my deep, dark secrets. That doesn't work. There's a period of getting to know people. And that might be that starts at a family gathering where they have guests and you got to know that person there. So you liked the way that they looked. You liked the way that they were communicating. You liked the way that they think. And you continue wanting to talk with them, so you go out for coffee together before you invite them over to your house. This is where you start developing what's called trust and respect for each other. A lot of people think that you got to go straight to the topics of interest. And that's good conversation piece, and that's what you're supposed to do to be a nice guest at somebody's dinner table. But the reality is, to become friends with somebody long term, it's not just the topical interest. Can you actually trust that person and there's mutual respect between you? And the way you test that is by you get to a point of saying, well, there's a little secret I'm going to tell you. And if they keep that, then you can tell them another secret that might be a little bit bigger. And if they don't use that against you and you know they're not out telling other people about it, then you can get to the point of saying, you know, I can be vulnerable with you to let you know things about me, but it has to be mutual. So the respect, the trust has to be the foundation of that before you actually reach the level of what's called friendship. And all of this, what you're really examining is you're examining how your value system matches with each other. What is your attitude about things? You're looking at things about morals and ethical standards could be part of the development in getting into a friendship. Now, not all friendships have to be romantic. There can be social friendships. They can be friendships that are developed at your place of worship. It could be a friendly location that you like to go just to relax every once in a while. It could be playing a sport where you meet somebody and you have common interests. But even though people may like to play the same sport, doesn't mean that they're going to be friends. There are also people who tend to be extrovert in their style of communicating and their social behavior, who walk into a room of 100 people and say, all of you are my friends, I'm so glad to be here. Where the introvert says, all of these are my acquaintances, very few are my friends. It's not because one is better than the other. It's not because one is right or one is wrong. It actually is because the use of the word friendship may have different degrees. To the extrovert, who's very open and lively and wants everybody to communicate freely and they think that they're accepting and they want to be accepted, they can use the word friendship in a more blossomy kind of a term. But the introvert wants that not to be a blossom, but wants it to be a bloom from the root. So they get to know the person. There's very few that they're happy to call friends. For them to call a person friend is a very serious thing. Again, we don't look at this as right or wrong or good or bad. What happens in the long-term situation, and there are people that have developed relationships here that is a community where people come and go very quickly. And there have been long-term relationships. And the reason they were able to do that is because they came into a world where there's excellent communications. So you don't have to lose your contact with people. You can always be communicating with them electronically. And you can do all kinds of communications and awareness, sending pictures to each other in a second through various social media. You know, so people can actually stay in contact with each other for a very long time.
What about the ones you don't want to stay in contact, though? I guess that's what I'm talking about, those toxic friendships that can... You've become friends with somebody, maybe a mutual friend introduced you, you're both living in Dubai, so you create this relationship that is friendly, whether it's a full friendship yet, and later you find that actually that person is not any good for you. They're either very emotionally draining, they're very needy.
Sure.
What advice do you give somebody then? Because you must have people come to you who tell you about this relationship they've got with a friend, and you're like, that is not a friendship that you should have. This person is bad for your personality.
Sometimes people realize it on their own, but usually it can come from somebody else. And it's not always taken as truthfully because they doubt that the other person is telling them for the right reason. They think, oh, the other person is just jealous of my relationship, rather than they're actually working in my best interest. Many times, especially younger, inexperienced individuals will want a relationship to work and not see the destruction, particularly if that destruction is because they tend to be manipulated by the other person and they're not seeing it, but family or other friends might see it. When you are aware that there is a problem in the relationship, depending on your personality and the personality of the other person, you might just phase out of the relationship. Some people can't do that. Some people need to have direct closure. And not everybody will, but some people who need direct closure might go to that person and says, I'm glad that we met, but I'm at the point now where I'm not comfortable with the many times that we've met. That's getting to be too much. I'm feeling very drained. And they can actually be that blunt with the other person. Now, the other person might not be aware of any of this because they may be so narcissistic. I'm not talking about a narcissistic personality disorder. I'm talking about they may have some narcissistic characteristics, or let me put it more correctly, they may be eccentric. And they don't really pay attention or have the sensitivity what other people think about them. They're just happy to hear themselves talk, thinking that they're entertaining, because they can be entertaining. Nobody stopped them before, so why is that wrong? And when a person comes to them and says, our relationship is fine, but I want to push back a little bit because it's getting to be too draining, the other person may need to know what is draining and may even be willing to change. But you're still not willing to make the sacrifice that you feel like you've already been doing. So the two points that I'm making right now, either you can get the direct closure by dealing with it. And I don't like to use the word confrontational because that suggests you have to get argumentative sometimes. But sometimes if you can be cooperatively discussing what the problem is and you need to back away from it, that may be more accepted than I don't like you, you're really draining me, I'm getting sick of you, or something like that. Now, I don't think people would necessarily do that unless they are very, very sick of what's going on. And again, the other factor on that approach from the other side of the continuum is to just kind of bow out, gracefully move away, and nobody has to say anything. Sometimes people have the kind of connection with each other, they don't have to use words, but behavior will show the direction that they're going.
Giving me his expert opinion on a whole range of ways to deal with difficult people. We started in the workplace, Dr. Raymond, today, and we've moved through family onto friendships. And let me read you this. I should have seen it coming. We'd been together for over a decade, but for the past year or so, things just hadn't been the same. There was no big betrayal, no shocking infidelity, no bitter rows about money, but something had started to fade. The spark had gone. Social events became awkward. We couldn't even have a cup of tea at our favourite cafe without there being an atmosphere. Before long, what had started out as drifting apart turned into irreconcilable differences. The end, when it came, was civil, yet brutal. We may as well call it a day, I was told. In shock, I called a friend and relayed the conversation I just had, and she said, oh my goodness, you've just been dumped, confirming what I already knew. I'd indeed been dumped, but not by a long-term partner or spouse. The dumper was a friend, or to put it more accurately now, a former friend. And I think it's a problem that people do deal with, that, you know, breaking up a relationship, a romantic relationship, a marriage, not easy, of course. And yet we sort of feel that we can bring up those problems with a spouse, for example. But in a friendship, Dr. Raymond, people seem to find it difficult to break up. And you were talking there earlier about there being two ways to do it. You can have that conversation. Look, things aren't working out anymore. I don't think we should spend as much time together. Or you can do what this same article refers to as the slow fade. When a friendship cools, the article says, it's seldom so straightforward. Death and betrayal aside, there are two ways to end it. The slow fade out, where you try to downgrade an intense friendship to something more casual, or the short, sharp split. Now, I know I've done the fade out, okay? And I think a lot of people out there will have. You've started to not maybe get back to messages so quickly. You've started to not be available to meet up as often. You're trying to spare their feelings, but sort of make it obvious that you're not necessarily going to do everything together. But when I did that, I found myself then getting quite a lot of anxiety and guilt from the fact that I suddenly wasn't available for this person. So should I have sat down over a cuppa and said, look, you know, I just don't think we've got it anymore? It just seems like an odd conversation
That's
to have with a friend.
That's not part of your personality. That
no,
is not your personality.
That would have been very hard.
Yeah, of course. And you couldn't do it because it's not part of your personality. When people read textbooks, this is the problem with self-help books. Self-help books only help the person who wrote the book because it doesn't match everybody's lifestyle. It doesn't match everybody's personality. They're good guidelines. I'm not saying anything's wrong with self-help books. If you don't take them to heart and believe that that has got to be the only way to handle it, it may be a guideline. And a good book to read or a show to watch or a program that if any type of assistance that would help you was one that gives you a lot of different options. But you need to know who you are first. When it comes to decision-making, some people are happy to put their emotions into it, and others want to compartmentalize the emotions and only think about the decision because for them, that's the only way that they can be fair and objective. The person who allows their emotions to come in could be actually misinterpreted to be manipulative with their tears, take things way too personally when they're not even doing that at all. It's just that they're putting in their personal values. The person who compartmentalizes their emotions may be the person who looks cold, callous, different, and distant, not believing that they could even have emotions. Well, both of those may be different or wrong interpretations. So you have to know your personality to know where can you draw the line, but also being sensitive to the other person as well. So if you choose to kind of phase away, and phasing away doesn't mean that the other person will catch on immediately, because in a busy world, you don't always have time to answer all your SMSs, WhatsApp, what's wrong with the telephone, you know, kind of a thing. You're not always able to do that, so that people might not catch on immediately and say, okay, they're probably busy. But when you're busy two or three times in a row, and the distance and the frequency becomes less and less frequent, more distance between contacts, that's when they start to get the message. Here's what needs to be understood, though. When that person asks you what is going on, that's when you have to be ready to tell them.
To be honest,
regardless,
yes, at that point.
You got to tell them, and that's what you have to prepare for. Even for your personality, Claire, who tends to be gentle, who tends to be accommodating, you like to actually coordinate and cooperate with people. You like to see the good things about other people. You like to get a good balance. You're going to still have to be ready to tell the person, you're a wonderful person, but...
Because otherwise I'm making it far worse, aren't I? I mean, isn't it always worse,
yes,
to let somebody be hanging and not know what the problem is, or even that there is a problem? It's a little bit like the emotional equivalent of ripping the plaster off quickly or peeling it off slowly, isn't it? Isn't it always better to be up front? And yet, I'm thinking of another scenario that a friend of mine told me, and this is a guy actually, which I was quite surprised about. He actually sat down somebody he'd just met. They met up, they'd met at a social engagement. They arranged to meet up, they'd got on well. And he actually sat the guy down and said, look, actually, I'm not going to be able to see you again. My life's really busy. I've got my wife, I've got my kids, I've got loads of friends, and I just don't have time in my life for a new friendship. I can't see you again. And I remember being like, oh, wow, how did you have that conversation? How awkward. And I was so surprised that somebody had done that. But really, with hindsight, a way better way to treat somebody, maybe upfront and honest.
And it's also comforting that they were telling you the truth and it wasn't to be taken personally. Now, let me tell you why it wasn't to be taken personally. The message that was really given is, when I like somebody, I want to be able to give them the time and the attention that they deserve. And I want
it's
the same
exactly
in return.
That's exactly what he meant. Absolutely.
That's exactly what they meant. But when it's like, I really don't have time to be friends right now. Oh, what is wrong with me? Maybe there's nothing wrong with you. Maybe they're saying that I want to be friends with you, but I want to be friends with you when there is the time, that's available to give each other the attention. That actually becomes a compliment rather than seeing it destructively. What is destructive is when a person is asked the question, oh, nothing is wrong, I've just gotten very busy. Well, you've been very busy before. Why do you have to be distant with your busyness now? Also, some people can handle being together 24/7. Some people say, I'm really glad that you go do what you need to do, I do what I need to do, and we get together a few times a week. It's not a matter of what's good and what's bad. It's not a matter of which definition is the only definition of spending time together to be a friend. It's how both of you coordinate. If you need 80% of your time with your friend, and that friend only needs 50% of their time with you, you're going to have some problems.
Yeah, or already, you have to find a compromise, I guess.
Already, one is going to feel suffocated, and the other is going to feel abandoned. So you have to come to a definition, and that definition is best realized when you can say to each other, I really care about you a lot, but I need to have to do things. I need to get a balance in my life where I do things on my own. I do things with other friends, and we have time for each other. I have time for worship. I have time for my work, whatever the case may be. And then when you understand that, you won't take it personally when that friend of yours isn't going to be with you at a particular time, because now you understand that's their time alone. And you care about each other enough that you can appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, it comes back to communication again, doesn't it? As so many of these things too do. An interesting one here, Dr. Raymond from Luca, says it's even more difficult when your best friend is also your boss at work. Work and friendship really do affect each other. Sadly, the boss in this friendship has eventually used the unwritten power to destroy the friendship, Luca says. We used to separate work and friendship very well, but now both things have become a mess. I'm losing my friend, and my job is not as happy anymore. So really interesting, yeah. Those two things clashing.
Sometimes that gets into a crossover that's called a dual relationship. And some companies actually have a rule that you're not supposed to do that. I'm not sure how advisable that is, because there are going to be people that work together that can actually live together and work together. And they're happy to do that because they have the kind of personalities that match each other. They're aligned with each other. Others say, I like the person a lot. They're my best friend, but I don't want to be with them all the time. I'd like to be able to go to separate places for our work. And then we get together every evening for dinner, and we chat, we watch a movie, we go home to our respective locations, and that's what we need in our relationship. So a best friend isn't somebody that's there day and night with you. Now, where you have to also be careful is in today's world, there's no gender preference for friendship. So when a romantic relationship is actually causing the problem, that can be very destructive. And that's where you have to be very careful when you develop a romantic relationship with somebody who is a friend and becomes romantic, and you're also working together. That's where you have to really define the boundaries.
Yeah.
You have to very, very carefully define boundaries, not because of the present situation, because it might be just a honeymoon phase. And we're not talking about an affair. We're talking about two people who are available. They like each other. They want to have that kind of a relationship. But you have to make sure that you prevent issues that could come up in the future.
And is that something you need to do right at the very start? So either if you're starting a relationship, or if you end up working in the same place as your friend, particularly if one of you is senior to the other, should you have that conversation early doors? Let's set the boundaries now of where we are when we're out as friends and where we are when we're in the workplace.
It doesn't have to be before you start the relationship, of course, you know, because how do you know you're going to start one? But it should be within the early, you're right, it should be within the first several days or weeks when you realize that you're beginning to formulate a dual relationship. And it will not affect your relationship with the other people at work.
Okay, we've had another one in here from Conjit. It says, I met a woman who I call a friend now for 8 years. I met her through another friend. We became close and we get together a lot with our kids. We spend Christmas and Easter together. We're both away from family. But however, I feel she has changed over the last year. She compares her life a lot with me and other friends, which I don't like, and it makes me uncomfortable. She wants people to give her a different level, I guess, of respect is what she means here, because she's married to a certain person. Whereas I feel nothing has changed in her life since the day we met. What do I do to stop this situation getting worse? So I guess the dynamic has changed in this friendship,
mm-hmm. Yes,
to some extent. And Conjit just wants to know, what can she do to nip it in the bud?
Well, one of the things you have to do is be willing to openly discuss this with the person. The other person may not be willing to do that, though. And I'm giving you things that may not have been written in here, but they're also possibilities. So there are different possibilities. But if the other person is not willing to talk about these situations, then you might have to say to them, I really care about you. I really enjoy our relationship. But right now it seems like we may need to kind of put a little bit of a damper and distance our relationship so that we won't get into some problems later. And then if you can, explain what those problems are that you're predicting could actually happen. That's one way to handle it. Some people can also be very, very direct and say, here's what's happening. I'm appreciative of all the other things that you've got going on. I don't want to stand in your way. I want to be a friend when we're both comfortable to get together and there's no distractions or disturbances. We can intervene or interject however we feel comfortable. So again, you get back to what you said earlier. Communications is paramount. It is so important to be able to communicate clearly how you think, feel, and how you would like to behave. And just because they're not ready for that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with you or the relationship. You may have gotten to a point now where you have to redefine. It's like being good friends with a person who one day is going to meet someone that they're going to want to marry. That doesn't mean that they're rejecting you as a best friend for the person that they're going to marry, nor does it mean you have to compete with the person who they're going to marry. It doesn't have to be a straight line and that person's in the middle playing tug of war to get that person's attention. It can be a comfortable triangle.
Just a few minutes left of Dubai today, this morning. Myself, Claire Sharrock in the hot seat, and Dr. Raymond Hamdan in the even hotter seat over there. It's been a good show so far.
Well, it has. Thank you so much for being a wonderful host.
Oh, well, thanks for being here to keep me
company.
And
Jo's a great producer.
Oh, yeah,
too.
Well, she's awesome. So we're all okay if we're in Jo's hands. Let's just squeeze this one message in. We've got a few more coming in. I can't get to them all today, but we'll read this one. I'm going to have to cut it down a little bit because it's long. But this listener says, when my husband's affair came out into the open, my two closest friends knew about it and got some other well-meaning people to tell me at the end of a party. Needless to say, I lost all trust and faith in my two close friends, who drifted away gradually. I felt betrayed not only by my husband, but also by my friends. She goes on to say she does still see them in certain situations, and it's been quite difficult. What annoyed her more was that they blamed me for something that wasn't in my hands. They didn't even call after my husband left to see how I was or how my kids were doing. But then one needed help with something and did call and say I needed to help them. Sort of ends by saying, now I don't have a lot of friends who are close, and I'm happy with that situation. So quite a sad story there. Let down by her friends first because they knew about the affair. Two, it sounds like they didn't deal with it very well because they didn't tell her about it. They got somebody else to tell her about it. My thought here, Dr. Raymond, would be they weren't great friends in the first place, so no loss.
How would you tell your best friend that your partner is betraying you? That is a very difficult thing to do. And you're stuck between the fact that you might be friends of both persons. And you don't want to take the role of being one side against the other. Sometimes what people will do, they'll go to the person who's committing the naughtiness and say, this is what's happening. We don't appreciate it. We care about both you and your partner. You need to consider how destructive this is. And hopefully that person will stop doing the mischievous kind of a thing and put back his life or her life in line, whoever it is that's being out of line here. And what happens too is for the person who is the victim, many times that person not only will lose the spouse, but they also lose their friends. This is not an uncommon condition. And many times the person with whom the naughtiness is going on is the person that you're the closest to. So you lose everything and you feel totally distraught. What's also more compelling about this situation is the drain of having not known, feeling that you were stupid, you were ignorant, you should have been aware of all this stuff that's going on. So the person gets into this depressed mode, this anxious mode of, I was stupid, they made a fool out of me. People also will try to put blame for ignorance. You know what? If you're in a relationship where you have to be suspicious, you got to ask yourself, why do I want to use my energy to be suspicious? You need to be in a relationship where you can assume that things are correct. You don't need to be in a marriage where there's already mistrust. You need to be okay that you can trust and respect your partner, or you're going to have to ask yourself, why did I even allow myself to get into this marriage? So you didn't do anything wrong by assuming that you're safe in this relationship. That's actually a good base to go into a relationship. Because if you're looking at a relationship and you don't trust the person, you're not sure about respect, you don't need to be in that relationship. Whether it's romantic, that leads to marital, or whether it's a friendship at work or a recreational friendship as well. Where is the essence here? The essence is being able to trust and respect. So when that is betrayed, you didn't do anything wrong because you weren't aware of it. You were assuming that it's okay to be vulnerable with that person, that you were okay to call them a friend, to call them a partner in life.
Very difficult situation to be in. Thank you very much for sharing that story. Just time to share one more. Hibber says, I was in a suffocating long-distance friendship where my friend wanted very high level of contact. I couldn't keep up with it, and it meant they were consistently disappointed, and I constantly felt guilty and anxious. I had several times confronted the person about how needy they were with me, but they just brushed it aside. Finally, I had to just phase them out. They behaved quite irrationally after that, sent me many messages, cornered my family members for explanations, and emailed me with emotional blackmail. I ignored all of this, but I still wish I knew what I could or should do differently to end it amicably. I think, Hibber, sometimes it's just not easy to do that. But thank you very much for sharing your story this morning. We have run out of time for today. As always, fantastic discussion over the last 2 hours. Thank you so much for all your thoughts and contributions on this one. And thank you, of course, to Dr. Raymond Hamdan. It's been lovely to have you with us today.
Nice to see you again.
And Dr. Raymond, of course, from the Human Relations Institute and Clinics, and here often on a Wednesday for On the Couch. Thank you to him.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.